Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Tis the season, and today in the show we'll dive right into it headfirst with that time-tested holiday classic, The Nutcracker. But what exactly makes it so great? The Salisbury Symphony's David Hagee gives us his view from the conductor's podium. Piedmont Chamber Singers director Wendy Looker is here for a glimpse into the Moravian Christmas tradition, and the incredibly talented singer-songwriter Emily Hurd joins me live in Studio A. She's got a new Christmas album out, and you'll want to listen to it all year long. Peter Karoff is back with his take on that cat-like composer Claude Debussy. We'll be flies on the wall for a fascinating philosophical phone call between Green Hill Center for North Carolina Arts curator Edie Carpenter and artist Ken Kotara. Then we'll also enjoy some small talk with two of the world's most renowned miniature artists. Their amazing stamp-sized paintings are on display in Yadkinville next on Triad Arts Weekend. Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker has become one of the Triad's most cherished holiday traditions, with nearly a half dozen different productions going on here this season. The Piedmont Dance Theater's 10th annual production is Saturday night, December 15th at 6:30, and Sunday afternoon the 16th at 2 at Keppel Auditorium on the Catawba College campus in Salisbury. Rebecca Massey Wiley's unique family production features live music, comedy, and outstanding dancers. Dan Wiley as the mysterious Drosselmeyer, Erica Wesselman, the Sugar Plum Fairy, Samuel Chester, her cavalier, and William Hopp as the Nutcracker. Salisbury Symphony conductor and Wake Forest University Orchestra director David Hagee conducts. This year, he celebrates his 25th season with the Salisbury Symphony. He spoke with me by phone from Venice, Italy. Well, let's talk about the Piedmont Dance Theaters. This is their 10th annual production. They're sixth with you all, with the Salisbury Symphony. What's that collaboration like? How does it work?
Well, it's some of the most fun things, I think, that we get to do in our own seasons all year. And it's not just the thing that you pull out every year to do the same. It's also craftful, so it's also fun for musicians to work out and get right. They enjoy doing it. And so that's fun for us. It's a little different for me in that I can't just do the tempo I want. I have to watch dancers' legs and see that, well, this afternoon, the dancer's not as warmed up as well as they might like to be, so they're not going to want that quite that slow, or they're not going to want this quite that fast. So I love that challenge of figuring out what the dancer really wants and what they will do their best with.
Well, I know this is described as your favorite concert of the year. I'm not going to have you do a history of composition 101, but if you could, just for listeners who know nothing about Tchaikovsky, nothing about classical music, where does this man fit in terms of the history of, say, 19th century composition? What's he best known for?
Well, the two things best known are, of course, this Nutcracker that we're about to do, and the piece that's become the July 4th celebration piece for all of America, which is really about the celebration of the Russians over Napoleon's forces, which is the 1812 overture. And I think all of us know etc. But he's not just that. He was really one of the Romantic eras, the 1800s eras, best composer of beautiful melodies. And not only did he do beautiful melodies, he had the compositional awareness and great craft to score them for orchestra so beautifully. So there are many things. We know his piano concerto. Many people would recognize the melodies from that. And a variety, his symphonies, his last three symphonies in particular, are melodies that have had words added to them in the middle of the 1900s and became popular songs. So he really wrote more music than the average music listener is aware is Tchaikovsky's, and a really great talent, I think.
You just said early on, David, the way he scored for orchestra. We're talking about orchestration there a little bit. For the non-musician out there, and we mentioned celeste early on as one kind of unusual instrument that he chose for the Nutcracker.
Which is a wonderful choice because it had just been invented, and he went to Paris and heard it and snuck it in. Took great care to make sure that no one at the conservatory heard it or saw it before it premiered in the Nutcracker, because he thought it was such a unique new sound.
Well, What are some other examples in this particular score, David, talking about the music for the Nutcracker, in which you find just the, I don't know, whichever, the shimmering sounds up top or the rumblings in the bottom that really move you? What do you love about this music?
Oh, there's so many. Well, in the march, for example, the famous one, dum pa ba ba bum 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 bum. In the course of that, the second time that melody happens, there is a constant run. It's like a circle of very quick notes. It's hard to sing them, of course. But if you listen carefully, you'll hear them. And only five notes at a time are played by any one section. And they all hook together absolutely flawlessly as one long line of quick notes, and if you listen carefully, you can hear that just adding the energy to this march all around it. That's an example of some of the skill and craft that he had.
That's a great example of the combination of you get the woodwinds doing that trade-off thing and then the brass doing the little march entrance, and what a great juxtaposition.
Exactly.
You hear the chimey celeste, da 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 da, and eventually, do-do-do-do-do.
Oh, the lovely bass clarinet at the bottom. Oh, that's such a wonderful contrast. I think it's got to be pointed out that it's not just Tchaikovsky who did all this. It's also the wonderful choreographer, Marius Petipa, who told Tchaikovsky, now I need 8 bars in 4-4 for this to happen. Then I need 16 bars in 3-4 for this to happen. He designed this music meter by meter, step by step, the choreographer.
Yes, and that didn't go over so well with Tchaikovsky, I understand.
Well, he took it eventually, and, you know, he would occasionally say, now, we need to add an extra bar here. I just can't fix that. It's got to be that. And then Petipa would adjust the choreography, and it was one of the most collaborative workings together of choreographer and composer that we've ever had. And as a result, the music really, truly depicts the story.
Salisbury Symphony conductor and Wake Forest University orchestra director David Hagee. He'll lead the Salisbury Symphony in a performance of Rebecca Massey Wiley's choreography to the Nutcracker Ballet, featuring some of our area's finest dancers and several outstanding guest artists as well. You'll find links to ticket information and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. The Piedmont Dance Theater's 10th annual production is Saturday night, December 15th at 6:30, and Sunday afternoon the 16th at 2 at Keppel Auditorium on the Catawba College campus in Salisbury. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we're off to a Pictures at an Exhibition phone call. Imagine being entrusted with exhibiting hundreds of works of art simultaneously in one space and making sure that each work be given a chance to shine. All in a day's work for Green Hills Center for North Carolina Art, Director of Curatorial and Artist Programs, Edie Carpenter. She's curated more than 25 exhibitions for Green Hills Center, including the mother of all exhibitions, the annual Winter Show, Invitational Survey Exhibition of North Carolina Art in all mediums. Winter Show runs through January 13th, with all of the 400-plus works for sale just in time for that perfectly unique North Carolina-centric gift on your holiday shopping list, or maybe just a little gift for yourself. Edie stopped by with her curator's point of view, and we eventually got Asheville-based artist and Winter Show exhibitor Ken Kotara on the horn. What's your mindset when you're first viewing this work and assembling this over what's, I understand, is like a 7-month process?
Well, this is the 8th time that I've done this. And admittedly, the first time I did it, it was absolutely daunting. And I don't think there's many curators that would want to take on this project annually. I don't hand pick or select every single piece of art in the exhibition. I do select the artists, and we do have a kind of a worksheet for the exhibition for a kind of distribution between the two-dimensional and three-dimensional works, painting, printmaking, glass, wood, metal, sculpture, and photography. And so we have a certain amount of slots to fill, as if it's a, sort of an orchestra. You want everybody to be able to play together, yet be perceived in their individual creative world. And that's the difficulty of this show. I think that we find the challenge every year is in the installation. You know, a strong artist has a resonance that is individual. And if you bring all these individuals together in a room and not have them scream at each other, that's the hard thing, to give everyone their own space and have the crowd get along. And so that's what we do. And I think that's what we do so well. Every year, it's not simply bringing together artists in different mediums, but also artists at different stages of their careers. And Winter Show, for us as a kind of contemporary exhibition space, is the exhibition where we can introduce new artists to the gallery, such as Ken Katara, originally exhibited in a Winter Show in 2007 before being included in two group exhibitions, which were thematic exhibitions, most recently in a large drawing show. I would say in every Winter Show, we have perhaps 10 to 15 of the artists or will be considered to be emerging artists and really, you know, at the brink of embarking on a career in the arts.
Which ties directly into the mission of Green Hill.
All the work is for sale. So there is, you know, the aspect that we are trying to not only give the artists a showcase, a visibility, but also have them collected by the collectors that come to Green Hill. And our members are all very interested in not only seeing our exhibitions, but often collect works from the gallery. So there is that aspect. You know, it's always a surprise that some of the most innovative works are collected in every Winter Show, such as one of Ken Katara's Braille works was just bought by a collector.
Well, let's get Ken on the phone and see how he feels about that.
Our studio.
Were your ears ringing, Ken? We were just talking about you. Last we spoke, I was talking with you about some Spanish moss-ish images and this notion of making a grid, looking at the works we last spoke of, colorful winding images, and comparing it now to these beautiful, very symmetrical Braille layout, very different on the surface at least.
Different, and yet it's also to me still part of the same language, in that, you know, it is grid-based like the Barbe Espanol series, but also geometric. And as I was looking just to expand my own vocabulary, I just happened upon Braille one evening, I think, on the internet. And it immediately struck me of the similarities, of course, and yet the difference. To where the Braille came from was looking at, here I am touching all these materials and working within this visual art language, and yet there's still a sector of the public that cannot see it and cannot experience the way I do. So now I'm looking at, if I'm almost extruding the image out of the surface to create this three-dimensionality. And so I'm beginning to really enjoy working with materials that are more tactile, that are more raised, and that are different from what I'm normally accustomed to. And because I see us all, you know, we're all impaired within some context. And so the Braille component is that there are people who are blind who are physically impaired. All of us, maybe by ideological, philosophical reasoning, are impaired by others. I believe a certain thing, so sometimes maybe I am cutting myself off to something else.
Are you at all a John Cage fan, Ken? I can't remember.
I am. I truly am.
This is ringing really true. We just had a big Cage Fest here at Wake Forest, and he's been on my mind. But the whole image of the ching and chance element and making decisions, asking questions, seems to come out in some of your work.
And that's exactly what I do. Every time I ask a question, there's a sequence that goes on. I put forth a question, and here's an answer. That answer usually begets another question. And sometimes I can go back and look at this and be surprised at where I might end up. And sometimes it's right back close to where I began.
Hmm.
The abstract painter Piet Mondrian speaks about Chance, saying chance must be avoided as much as calculation, and that the ideal for him was a kind of what he termed an higher intuition. And I think that Ken's work has this very intuitive, when I hear him speaking, I feel like it doesn't quite translate the kind of reverberating intensity of his work when you actually are in front of it, standing in front of it. And the way that his curvilinear lines and circles, the vertical sweep of them, and the density of the layers, the way the backgrounds in his large abstract paintings really bring up associations with a memory, a kind of an elated sense of memory of nature to me. And I do think that he is translating a sense of balance when he speaks of the origin of the work in the grid. But what's wonderful is his play with that balance and that kind of the juxtaposition of the various layers, which include drips that fall down the surface. And then this third element, I'm speaking of the large painting that's in the center of our large wall at Greenhill.
Is that This Is the Room of My Waiting?
The Barbe Espagnole.
It's number 55 in the ongoing series of Barbe Espagnole works. And in this work, the grid pattern of red-orange dots, which reflect the pattern that the Braille words would have taken, is a different system that hovers, you know, that's a different layer, which is added to the process that he's been working on for years.
So,
and he has a way, I think, of taking a whole thought system and adding it to his ongoing evolution as an artist.
This one author stated that we look at ourselves as to what we think we are, and then what other people think we are, and then what we really are. And when I think about my work, and I create the work, and then, of course, I put it out there, then that work actually becomes something else. It's less about me and then more about the viewer. And I find it interesting about the way I go about and create almost like this architectural structure. And yet everyone, of course, will walk through this and react to it differently. And so I'm always interested and fascinated when someone else may look at my work and say, well, I see it in this light. And I think it's part and parcel to, I don't know, it's like, keeping myself awake through this almost my own expectations of looking at new and different aesthetics, a new code, so to speak, as every time I approach a work of art.
Greenhill Center for North Carolina Art, Director of Curatorial and Artist Programs Edie Carpenter, and Asheville-based artist Ken Kotara. Greenhill Center's annual Winter Show Invitational Survey Exhibition of North Carolina Art in All Mediums runs through January 13th at Greenhill Center in downtown Greensboro. You'll find links to more Winter Show information and Kotara Studios at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and we'll take a short break now. Then it's time for more art, but teeny tiny art like you've never seen before. The miniature art husband-wife team of Wes and Rachel Segrist join me for some insight into their fascinating art, and singer-songwriter Emily Hurd joins me on the second half of the show, live in Studio A. Stay with us. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. Exquisite Miniatures 2, the traveling exhibition, is on display at the Yadkin Cultural Arts Center's Wellborn Gallery. The exhibit of all new miniature works by renowned miniature painting artists Wes and Rachel Segrist will remain on display there through Saturday, December 22nd. The tiny Segrist paintings are so exquisitely crafted that they often are mistaken for photographs. Viewed under magnification, the paintings convey a feeling of an enormous canvas. Together, the Segrists have been capturing the essence of the natural world in miniature for decades. They spoke with me by phone from their home studio in Tennessee. How do you do it? The craft of miniature art, how big is the brush, that sort of thing, and what is pointillism?
I use a smaller brush most of the time than Wes, usually a 10-aught down to a 20-aught, which has about 6 hairs on it, comes to a really incredible point. And basically, you just start working up values and colors, and especially on portraits, on the skin, you try to not let your brush mark show as much, so you're working very close to the same value you had just previously laid down. So you're gradually working darker and then lighter in areas is the way I do it. Wes probably has a different answer.
Yeah, I typically say when people ask me that question that miniature painting is not the joyous experience that a lot of conventional art is. I mean, you don't step back with an expressive brushstroke or shape a, you know, even if you were to look at it in 3D, a sculpture. This is not something that is typically fun at the process of working. It's tedious. It's painstaking. And sometimes you're holding your breath and crooking your head and moving your glasses if you're wearing them, or if you're using a magnifying glass, you're trying to get that in conjunction with everything else you're doing, all to make one little mark. And when you finally get it to that point, you realize the paint dried. And you got to start all over again. So the joy in miniature art for most miniaturists is watching the public see them and the collectors interact with them. I mean, then they step back and say, how in the world did you do that? And, you know, you just want to sit there and smugly say, well, it was easy. But it's not. It's something that you struggle with, and you hope you get it right. You do a lot of little tiny dots. We're usually not trying to do something that stands out as garish. You know, you don't want these brush strokes to show. It's not something that somebody says, wow, look at that juicy brush stroke, how he laid that in there. In most miniature paintings, you're looking at it through a magnifying glass saying, look at all the marks they put in there. That must have taken them hours. And it did.
I'm not understanding how that you can create such a depth of field and such a tiny surface. Looking at, as an example, the view from Yosemite Valley, I mean, it's almost like the Andes of Ecuador by, you know, Frederick Church on this 15-foot panel, but it's on the size of a penny. I mean, how do you do it? That just, to me, just blew me away.
Well, that's one she did, but she would be using the same principles as Church. I mean, one way they say it is miniature art is fine art in little. And basically, anything that happens in the conventional scale in the conventional art world is translated down into miniature. And sometimes there's a give and take there. Obviously, there's probably a lot more brushstrokes, for instance, in Church's work than there would be in Rochelle's tiny little landscape. But when you look through a magnifying glass at a certain section, Church's would be extremely painterly. Where Rochelle's, I mean, you would think there's a whole lot more marks in her piece, but again, hers is only 4 inches across, where his is 15 feet. But the principles of values and colors, atmospheric perspective, making things recede off into the distance, making them brighter as they're closer to you, all of those art principles come into play with miniature art just as they would in conventional art. The only difference is you sometimes have to be a little more sensitive with a miniature because it's so tiny. You might not be able to have as much contrast in it. We try to downplay obvious brush strokes or texture to a piece, anything that would distract a viewer's appreciation when they're looking at it really, really close.
That was a landscape example. Thankfully, on the website, you've got it all laid out for me. You all have gorgeous collections of birds, butterflies, fish, reptiles, landscapes. Which are your favorites?
Gosh, it's kind of what inspired you lately, like the view from Yosemite Valley. I had done that right after we had made a trip out there for the first time and taken a photograph and experienced it. And so later that month or a couple months later, of course, that's something that was very inspiring to me. I was very excited about painting it. Other times we'll visit zoos or go on hikes where we are here or be down in Florida by the ocean and the water birds, and it kind of changes, I would say. It's what has inspired you recently.
I think the biggest hurdle to get over is that great joy and anticipation you have when you start, and then the struggle you have dealing with the defeat along the way, where the brush or the paint and, you know, your hand and your eye just don't seem to work the way you want it to. I deal a lot with humidity. If the humidity gets too low with the miniatures and, you know, such a tiny little brush and a tiny amount of paint, it dries out, and that can be very frustrating. So the hardest part is, as you get towards the end, making sure that you've captured in your painting what originally inspired you and had you so excited to do it in the first place. You know, and along the way, hopefully also create a piece of what is considered fine art and something that people are going to marvel over with a magnifying glass. So it's a learning process and a lot of different levels of what we're doing there.
How does your relationship with a piece of art change throughout that time period from start to finish, and you know, through the struggles and the joys of it, I guess?
Well, usually it starts out as a love relationship, and sometimes it can go through hate relationships and back to love, and probably a lot of ups and downs, almost like a roller coaster ride. Start out good, and then it's all going good and fun and games, and then all of a sudden, oh my, this is not what I was planning, and you just keep plugging away at it, and then it gets back to where you're happy with it again, and it's back to fun and games, and this can yo-yo back and forth several times with me. Occasionally, like the painting I'm working on now, it's been pretty much fun and games from the beginning, and I'm hoping it stays that way until the end. So.
Renowned miniature painting artists Wes and Rachel Segrist. Exquisite Miniatures 2, the traveling exhibition, will remain on display at the Yadkin Cultural Arts Center's Wellborn Gallery through Saturday, December 22nd, 226 East Main Street in Yadkinville. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. The YCAC opened September 18th, 2010, and it's quickly become a vital fixture in the community, connecting people to the arts and to one another. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and I look forward to connecting you to more arts in just about 60 seconds. After the break, it's Keroff at the keyboard and his impressions of impressionistic French composer Claude Debussy, A Moravian Christmas with Piedmont Chamber Singers, and singer-songwriter Emily Hurd joins me live in Studio A next when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford, and this is Understanding Classical Music with Keroff at the keyboard.
That's such beautiful stuff. Music of Claude Debussy. Debussy is known as a musical impressionist. I hasten to add that Debussy hated that term himself. He didn't like to think of himself as an impressionist, just as a French composer. But the fact is, there's a lot about visual impressionism that can shed some light on Debussy's music. Now, I don't know if you can bring to mind a beautiful impressionist painting with all of these beautiful short brushstrokes juxtaposed one next to the other. They sort of blend in the viewer's eye, as it were. You take a step back, and suddenly that what looks up close like a bunch of blobs becomes a gorgeous cathedral in the moonlight. Well, Debussy does some of that kind of thing, except in musical terms. Instead of a little blob of red and a little blob of green that then blend together in your eye, watch what he does. Here he'll take a G-flat chord and an F minor chord, maybe throw in a little E-flat, mix it up, and he'll superimpose them one on the other. And those beautiful harmonies then kind of blend, as it were, in our ear, not in our eyes. So there's something about Debussy's technique that makes that impressionist label stick. The other thing about Debussy's music that strikes me is that quite often many, many of the titles have a visual element to them. For example, Clair de Lune, Moonlight. Just the very title makes us hear it differently. It evokes a visual as well as an aural sensation. This idea, this sort of synesthesia, you know that word, that the idea that we can combine the hearing and the visual in a kind of unified sensation, that really appealed to Debussy. Here's another piece called Reflections in the Water. And again, it's a visual title that invites us to not just hear, but also to see. And then we can practically hear the drops in the little pond. I have to say that Debussy was really quite a musical innovator, just in terms of the purely technical side of things. The kinds of harmonies he used, the kinds of rhythms he used, really were innovative for their time and really point the way toward the next generation of the modernist composers. Now, they don't sound as harsh as a Stravinsky or a Bartok, perhaps, but listen to this harmony. Beautiful, beautiful, but let's look at it. It's an A major chord. And wait a second, what's this doing here? It's an A flat. We actually have two separate and distinct keys going on at the same time. The world of A major, the world of A flat major. If you put them together in the same place, it would sound terrible. But the way he voices it, it doesn't bother you. It's anything but ugly. And yet, wow, it breaks every rule in the rule book. And sometimes Debussy will use a scale called a whole tone scale instead of the traditional normal, in quotes, major scale. You get this effect. It's actually very subversive, that scale, because there's no key. In a major scale, you can always know where your home note is. And then you're home. In a whole tone scale, you can really stop virtually anywhere and feel just as stable as anywhere else. So it creates this air of mystery. And a lot of Debussy's melodies use those whole tone scales. So gently, quietly, Debussy is almost like he goes into the giant circus tent of musical history and slowly pulls up the stakes one at a time. And people inside the tent didn't realize it, but the tent was about to collapse on him. An innovator, a very sensual composer, Claude Debussy.
Steinway artist and Wake Forest University professor Mr. Peter Karoff at the keyboard. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. And you know, contrary to common folklore, it was not the Pilgrims who brought European classical music to America, but the Moravians. These German-speaking, music-loving Christians came to America and brought the music of Haydn with them. In fact, when Benjamin Franklin wanted to hear Haydn's Creation, he had to hop on a horse from Philadelphia, the then nation's capital, to the Moravian community just outside of town to hear a performance of it. On their 35th anniversary season, the Piedmont Chamber Singers are celebrating our Moravian musical heritage with a Moravian Christmas tonight at 7:30 in Calvary Moravian Church and Saturday, December 15th at 7:30 in Kernersville Moravian Church. On the program, Franz Josef Haydn's Missa Brevis Sancti Ioannis de Deo, finally nicknamed the Little Organ Mass. Piedmont Chamber Singers Artistic Director Wendy Looker spoke with me by phone from her studio in Greensboro.
The Moravians were very much responsible for bringing over the classical tradition, the Western European classical era style, to the U.S. and early colonial America. So going to a Moravian settlement was one way of hearing the popular music in Europe of the time.
That's perfect. And what a perfect setting. Calvary Moravian Church, that's on Holly Avenue in Winston-Salem. We get to hear the Piedmont Chamber Singers and performing music by Haydn. And it's a little short Missa.
It's a little brief mass, and what's really kind of charming and interesting about it is the Gloria movement and the Credo movement, which are traditionally very, very long. The texts are both very long texts. And so they tend to be, in the larger Haydn masses, they're drawn out into the equivalent of three movements, almost, three for the Gloria and three for the Credo. And here, they're extremely short. And they each movement starts out with each part of the choir singing different text at the same time. So it's a way to get through all of that text all at once. And it's really very brilliant the way Haydn constructs the counterpoint so that it all works and doesn't sound at all chaotic.
For the listener, I mean, let's face it, some of them, talk about Bach B minor master, some of them can be enormous works that are, it's a lot of music to absorb in a sitting. Let's talk about the Benedictus movement a little bit.
It's a soprano, a long soprano solo with organ. It's a really lovely organ part, organ and then soprano, really an aria, the Benedictus.
The Benedictus, and this is the different textures that Haydn creates.
Yes, and then we will also have a string quartet.
Great.
Not a full orchestra, but a string quartet. It's a small, you know, it's a very intimate piece, really, which is interesting because in 2 days from now, I'm conducting the bigger Mass in Time of War by Haydn, which is a much different piece. Similar language, and, you know, it still obviously sounds like a Haydn Mass. They both sound very much like Haydn, but the scope is very different, which will complement the Moravian music quite well.
The Moravian music that you'll be performing, who are some of the composers? Were they looking toward Haydn as a model at that time?
They may have been. The interesting thing I found about the American Moravian settlers is that they brought over all of the popular music of the time from Europe. So they had this really amazing collection of copies of popular works of the time. So they did know what was going on in Europe. So what we see in the Moravian music that they then came over and they continued to compose in that style. So the music will be somewhat similar to a Haydn or Mozart, to their language.
Any music by Moravian composer David Moritz Michael on the program?
Yes. Two pieces we'll be singing in German. In English, it's called Hearken, for I Bring You Great Joy. And that has a rather lengthy soprano solo in it. It's an interesting program because unless you're Moravian, you probably won't recognize these tunes as Christmas pieces. But the texts are very much Christmas texts. And then we'll round out the program with some familiar carols at the end.
I think most people are looking for something, you know, you want your familiar holiday traditions around Christmas time, but also some new, and in this case, some
sure.
new music. That'll be wonderful.
I think it's nice if whenever I do a concert, if I know that the audience will go away having heard something different, something new, or learned something they didn't know before. The Moravian tradition is such a big part of our culture here in Winston-Salem that, you know, I thought it would be appropriate, especially in our 35th anniversary year. PCS has been in Winston-Salem for 35 years, and I think it's nice to highlight our local heritage in our Christmas program.
I think it's interesting that you're choosing this anniversary to celebrate furthering that culture, you know, diversifying your audience and celebrating the diversity we've got right here in the Triad.
It's important to move forward as we also celebrate what we've already done. Through my work at Guilford College and working with so many young people, I see how popular choral music is with them. Young people really like singing in choirs. You look at someone like Eric Whitaker, who has his virtual choir, where
yes.
he has singers from all over the world videoing, recording themselves singing his music, and then they all come together and make this international choir. It's pretty amazing. And these students are so passionate about that. And I go to a conference and see, you know, a critiker signing autographs, and there's a line out the door of high school girls wanting to get his autograph. So choral music is popular with young people, and I don't always see young people at our concerts. So I want to find a way as we move forward into the next 35 years to encourage people who don't typically come to a choral concert to give it a try.
A growing demographic in our community, too, young people, but the Latino community. And looking back in October, it seems like you had a successful reach out into the Hispanic community here.
Yeah, we did a program entirely in Spanish, and yet there was an enormous variety in the type of pieces we sang. We sang all sorts of pieces from Renaissance, Baroque, to newly composed work. There was a choral conference going on, a festival going on that weekend, and an entire high school choir from Charlotte came to our concert. So we had a whole high school choir there in the audience, and their director told me that they were really, I don't think shocked is the right word, but well, pleasantly shocked, I guess. They heard some music they hadn't heard before. We sang some modern sort of avant-garde 20th century stuff that happened to be in Spanish as well. And, you know, that was really nice that they enjoyed hearing new music that they hadn't been exposed to before.
Sure, it was, you know, it was nice that they enjoyed the concert. But then again, you know, Wendy, you were really preaching to the choir.
I do that on a daily basis.
That's true.
Preach to the choir.
I'm sorry. I couldn't resist. I'm
so
sorry.
True.
<Go ahead.
laughs> So true. So true.
Piedmont Chamber Singers Artistic Director Wendy Looker. PCS celebrates the holiday season and the ensemble's 35th season of chamber music excellence with a Moravian Christmas. Tonight at 7:30 in Calvary Moravian Church and Saturday, December 15th at 7:30 in Kernersville Moravian Church. You'll find links to ticket information at wfdd.org/triadarts. On the program will be Franz Josef Haydn's Missa Brevis Sanctis Ioannis de Deo, also known as the Little Organ Mass, some seasonal Moravian music as well, and some of your favorite carols. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. A masterpiece. This is an album to fall into and swim in forever. That's what Paul Zollo of American Songwriter wrote about Chicago-based singer-songwriter Emily Heard and her 2011 release titled Long Lost Ghosts. Emily performed with her new band back in October at the Community Arts Cafe in Winston-Salem. Shortly after her annual visit to the Triad, Emily returned home to Chicago and began writing songs for her very latest album, Any Given Day. It's her 9th studio album. The band recorded them live on one November evening, mixed and mastered them in one afternoon, and sent them to be manufactured the next day. Any Given Day was just released last week on December 7th, so it's literally fresh off the presses, featuring John Abbey, Gerald Dowd, and Greg Ahlstrom. The album of Christmas songs features Emily Heard's sultry vocals as well, delivering messages of spontaneous celebration, humble gifts, and fundamental goodwill. We're sampling from it right now. This is Heart of Snow.
A sentimental side, you brought it out tonight, but you knew that by now. All of the things I want to last, they come too slow and leave too fast. And I can't.
Back in October, Emily Heard dropped by to talk about the music and her new band. Well, since you were so kind to haul not only your banjo, but the keyboard and your equipment, love to give listeners a chance to check out some of your music. I want to hear Heaven This Way. When did you first record this one?
2010.
Okay. So, Heaven This Way. If it's heaven when you're headed toward the light, I think I just saw it. Well, let's hear it, and then we can talk about it on the flip side. This is from the Daytime Fireflies album, Emily Heard and Heaven This Way, live in Studio A.
God, each time that you got a sense of peace, then I think I might know him, judging by going home this evening. The crackle of leaves and the humming of streets and the dancing of flies, and the thought of your face up ahead just a ways it pacifies. If it is heaven when you start heading for the light, then I think I just saw it, I think I just caught a glimpse tonight. While taking the back roads on my way back home in the rain, your house is a star, I'm driving my car to heaven this way.
Emily Heard joined me in Studio A. We start off with Heaven This Way. Powerful stuff. Just kissed a bit of God's lips.
I remember what the overwhelming feeling was, is that I was driving to my mom and dad's house in Rockford, Illinois. They lived back in the forest, and it was fall, my favorite time. I mean, just filled with glee.
Mm-hmm.
It was raining, and I just was thinking about the idea of, oh, I love the way their house looks in the woods. And when I got there, that feeling I knew was a song. And then I just try to not think about it very much. When you're writing a song at all. You got a piece of paper and you got a pencil. You don't edit yourself in the writing process. I really believe that.
Let it flow.
Let it flow. So I think I wrote the chorus to that tune immediately. I didn't edit it. I still haven't changed it. And then I wrote, you know, that third verse, if it's grace every time that you taste a bit of some glory, then I think I just kissed a bit of God's lips. That just fell out. I didn't think about it. It just happened. And then after I thought, oh, I like that format and I like these chords, then I thought, okay, you need a first and a second verse. And what are you feeling and what needs to be written? And as soon as I start seeing that I've contrived this in a way that's like too thought out, I think when I first started writing that tune, I had written something like, the tune starts now, if it's God each time that you've got a sense of peace, then I think I might know him. I think I had started writing that, I know God because, or something, you know, something the way that Emily would say it. Mm. And then I thought, oh, this isn't what this song wants at all, you know? And so then I backed up and I thought, how does this tune want to, you know, continue forth? And I found that it wanted to say that. I mean, that's the best way I can say it.
But ultimately what comes out is this beautiful song about just being, feeling so connected and which is something that's so hard to put into words. We've all had that before. You're walking down the street or you're driving your car and suddenly, oh, life is unfolding just the way it's supposed to somehow. But you captured it, I thought, in a nice way.
Yes.
Am I off on this too?
No, that's absolutely what it's about. Absolutely what it's about. And it's wonderful because as a writer, I think as an artist, I can feel it in you. You don't often sit down to talk about something when something's so good. And as an adult, I've really changed over to this idea of, wow, I feel amazing. And rather than call a friend and get a drink, I'm going to go and sit down with my instrument and try to, you know, do something with that. Because so frequently we're like, I'm just so down and I'm going to go pour out my heart. And anyway, so that has been a great thing that happens with sticking with music as an adult. So that song, absolutely. Good place. It came out. And thank God.
Well, thanks for not going and getting that drink, because I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so love that, and I want to hear more, Emily, as long as you're here. Long Lost Ghosts. Great lyrics, but also a gorgeous melody. I want to hear it again. Will you share it with us?
Of course.
Somewhere down the street, you thought my lips were honey and my hair was winter wheat, and it was in your... Now I'm on my way by Greyhound bus. I have come for you because I thought you were all there was. And you are. You came back from school with anger in your eyes, so I gave you a kiss that I hoped would save your life, and it did. In your mind, ooh, in the field the sun hung colors from above. I thought holding you was the first time I made love, and it was in my mind. Comes, shoo the pigeons from your toes, and we'll meet in the moonlight just like long lost ghosts. And you
Long Lost Ghosts, the title track from Chicago-based singer-songwriter Emily Heard's 2011 release. Emily's here live in Studio A on Triad Arts Up Close. It just sounds great. I admire any musician who can come into a dry studio, just you and your instrument, and play. Hats off.
Thank you.
Faith and Memories comes out in this tune for me, or believing in that so strongly. Tell me about how this song came about, if it's not too painful.
I'll tell you, absolutely. Oh, no, it's not painful at all. I've got a pretty good sense of humor about all matters. You have to have a pretty good sense of humor about all matters of the heart. I was driving out to New York. I had the idea that I was going to chase down an old love, and I was writing this tune on my ukulele. And I have to say that even though I say in the lyrics I was on my way by Greyhound bus, I was on my way by Subaru, but Greyhound bus just sounded better.
Yeah, it's nice rhythm to it.
I needed that. So I was on my way by Subaru to chase down this old love, and I was just, the song wrote itself immediately when I was finished seeing him, and I got there and he introduced me to his new girlfriend. And but at the time, I was just so naive and hopeful. And I thought, this is such a, I mean, who can't relate to that? You know, you hearken back, there's no taint on your, you know, previous memories. And so I did that, and the tune just fell out. And I love the idea of naivete. You know, when I was growing up, there was a statue in a cemetery near where my parents lived, and I thought that was the Statue of Liberty. And then down the street, there was this really tall building that I thought was the Eiffel Tower, because your world is so small. And I wanted to capture that feeling, you know, how you thought my hair was winter wheat, or I thought just giving you a hug was making love, or I thought, you know, you don't know better. And I feel like that's so magical. And so the tune sort of is supposed to feel like that.
I like how in so many of the lyrics you bring back the past into the present, as if this is who you are today. So it is real now. The line, those days are made for, no, those days were made for us, yep. And they are still. Does that speak to that, absorbing that experience and somehow?
Yeah.
I just think it's such a simple, beautiful way of putting that.
Yes. Well, at some point you have to stop talking in metaphor and actually just say, I feel like that's usually what I use the bridge for. Hey there, listener, in case you haven't picked up on where I'm going, this is what it is. And so I was just trying to say, listen, yes, you are still so much here. This, who I was and what I felt is still who I am today. The shards of the past still may have been broken, but you're still, they're still who you are currently. And so I'm not saying people don't grow or improve, but, you know, honestly, that's still, we're made up of our experiences. That's what that was alluding to. So,
yeah. Again, I appreciate when it's put that crisply.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
We got to move on with one last piece. Can we have one more? One more.
Oh, yes. One more. Okay. I definitely have it in me.
So what would you like to, what's another tune that you could share with us?
I've written a new tune. I wrote it on the banjo. It is the strongest song that I've written in a very long time. The lyrics are actually what I thought was mean. I have a tendency to write things pretty diplomatically, or I don't really say completely mean things. But I got permission from my very good songwriter friend in Chicago, Erin Tedesco, and she says, Emily, why don't you just let it go? If you want to write a song that's really, you know, powerful and you're not going to be nice, just do it. You don't have to be nice all the time. So I wrote this tune, and I just love it. It's a mean tune.
All right. Let's listen to Emily Heard being mean. And the tune is?
Extra, Extra.
Emily Heard live in Studio A. Extra, Extra. Wow, yeah, I gotta say, Emily, I think that's the first tune I've heard where the supposed cheated upon is so much the victor in so many senses. That's a very powerful song.
That's right. It's meant to, I don't know, just give some voice to the part of you that that wants to make the person that did you wrong hurt in front of other people. And it's such a terrible thing. And as a nice person, you know you don't do that. But I don't know. I guess I was actually releasing a very true part of me in writing that tune that just had been lied to and wanted somebody to know, hey, I know you lied to me. And even though I'm not going to, you know, out your name or out you to yourself or out you to my friends, I will at least write a song about it. And doesn't that feel really great? And yeah, the tune turned out great. I wasn't sure I was going to, you know, do anything with it, but I played it for the guys in Stone Blind Valentine. They said, oh yeah, we are so recording this song. So we awesome. Did, and it turned out just really great. The meter of it, it's just so, you know, God, you know, no, God, it's that menacing, you know, not messing around, simple rock beat behind it. So yeah, it was a wonderful tune. I just felt glorious when I got done writing.
My thanks to Chicago-based singer-songwriter Emily Hurd. Her exciting new band is Stone Blind Valentine. Her 2011 release is Long Lost Ghosts, and her brand spanking new Christmas CD is Any Given Day, just released last week. It's her 9th studio album, and we're sampling from the title track right now.
The morning glow in this great big town is the virgin snow on an ancient ground. I rub my eyes, but it's still the same. So I let my mind see what it may. Fields of white any given day.
You'll find links to Emily's website, album information, and more at wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's show. Senior producer for Triad Arts Weekend is Eddie Garcia. Be sure and tune in to next week's program when we pay tribute to Triad musicians, authors, and spoken word artists during Triad Holiday Celebration 2012. It'll be an entire hour of local performances here and only here on Triad Arts Weekend. If you have a song or a poem, short story, or dramatic reading that involves the winter holidays and it's no longer than 5 minutes in length, please send me a CD recording or MP3 of it and I'll consider including it in the broadcast. You'll find complete submission guidelines on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.